MV Ramana, welcome again to KBOO and the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Good to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
MV Ramana is a physicist and professor in Simon's Chair in Disarmament, Global, and Human Security at the University of British Columbia. He is an internationally recognized scholar on nuclear energy and author of many articles and books on nuclear issues. Well, congratulations on your new book, Nuclear is Not the Solution: The Folly of Atomic Power in the Age of Climate Change. In the introduction to the book, you say that, quote, although climate change scares me, I am even more scared of a future with more nuclear plants. So you immediately take up these twin horrors. Can you explain how you balance them or weigh these two threats as you intervene through the book?
Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you for featuring this book, Jan. And the point that you picked up on is one that I grapple with a lot because the problems with nuclear energy, the risks associated with nuclear energy, have been well known for a very long time. We've known for a long time that nuclear reactors occasionally have catastrophic accidents, as what happened at Chernobyl and Fukushima. And we know that all nuclear plants produce radioactive wastes that we don't have a demonstrated solution for, and which are going to be hazardous for hundreds of thousands of years. And some also worry about the fact that the technology to generate nuclear energy is closely linked with the technology to make nuclear weapons. And so these are sort of well-known risks. But in the last couple of decades, we've seen many people argue that the danger from climate change is so great that we have to consider nuclear energy regardless. And my book, I'm trying to argue why this is actually a false narrative, that nuclear energy cannot really help us with climate change, even if you were to disregard or to think to minimize in your own mind the risk associated with nuclear power. And basically, the way I explain in short is that even if you expand nuclear energy, it is not going to be concomitant with the scale of the requirement of climate change. And that spending money on this very expensive technology means that there is going to be less money available for other quicker, more practicable, and less risky solutions, including renewables and associated technologies. And therefore, in a certain sense, the expenditure on nuclear energy is actually going to be reducing the rate at which we are reducing emissions. Or to put it differently, in effect, you are actually going to end up with more emissions than you would have ended up at if you had spent all that money on renewables and practical other technologies.
You've
So,
taken up.
yeah,
Okay.
just to finish that, I just want to say that we are going to be ending up with the worst of both worlds in that we have not really mitigated climate change, but also increased the risks associated with nuclear energy.
So you take up the implausibility of building this so-called new generation of small nuclear reactors, described as SMRs. That's a common term, small modular reactors, or some people call them small modular nuclear reactors, bringing nuclear back into the term. But you've described the, aside from the enormous health and safety risks of this technology, just the plan for the rollout of them in a way that would meet the moment in terms of climate crisis over the decades is implausible. And I think it's striking the difference between, for example, in France, how France became a major builder of nuclear power plants in the 60s and 70s, how in the US there was a rollout of nuclear power plants. It's quite different from these competing entrepreneurial projects, you know, where there are a number of them competing for government contracts. How is that even conceived as plausible now that some of these designs could be embraced in the infrastructure, the supply chain? You know, all of the apparatus that has to be in place and the enormous investments. to make these new small modular reactors viable economically and to meet the moment in terms of the climate crisis. What is their best argument? Because on the face of it, it seems absurd.
Yeah, so I think the best argument from pro-nuclear advocates is that nuclear energy is necessary. I don't think they actually have a good argument for how nuclear energy is going to overcome all of the historical challenges nuclear reactor builders have faced. So let me first say a couple of words about the best argument. And it is that the need for reliable electricity requires us to have some kind of source of power that is what they call baseload. I think this is a very misleading term. It's not a term that actually will apply to how grids are evolving in the future. But that's basically the strongest argument for nuclear power, that we don't know how to balance a grid that is composed purely of renewable energy sources like solar and wind energy, because these are variable in their outputs. I say a little bit about that challenge in the book to explain that it's not really such an impossibility, that we do know a lot about this, but that there are questions which we cannot resolve right now simply because we don't know what technological innovations and devices are going to be sort of constructed in the future, and how, most importantly, how much these would cost. But that's the best argument, that maybe we might need nuclear energy to make sure that the electricity grid works well. But
just to say on that point, because it gets raised over and over again, that solar and that the nuclear industry, as you point out in your book and in the film Atomic Bamboozle, we'll be talking about that later, that the industry has not dismissed renewables, solar and wind, but they've said those are intermittent or not stable in terms of the base load operation of plants, and that nuclear is a bridge fuel, that it can bridge the interruption in power. And why is that an important argument to begin with? I think it has a premise behind it, that there is a kind of steady increasing amount of energy required through electricity required, and interruptions in that flow are unacceptable. I mean, is that a fair premise to begin with?
So yes and no. It is true that we have come to expect as a society that when I switch on the lights come on. And that requires that when I switch on the light in my room, somewhere electricity generating plant is going to be producing an infinitesimally greater amount of power so that my light can be turned on, right? So because electricity, the demand and the supply have to be matched at all times, there is a need to think about how that is going to be met. And traditionally, the way that electricity was supplied was through large generators, coal, nuclear, hydropower dams, and things of that sort. And then subsequently, by the 90s, we started getting also large natural gas-based combined cycle plants. And during those phases, the way that people who were managing the electricity grid thought about meeting the demand and ensuring the reliability of this electricity supply was to think that there is this base load of demand, the lowest point below which the demand never dips. And that's because the demand for electricity goes up and down during the day, during the year. And there is a sort of a lower threshold below which it typically does not go down. And so the argument was that level was going to be met by plants that operate all the time, coal plants and nuclear plants. It's not that they cannot be shut down, but for operational and economic reasons, it is better to run these continuously 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, except when they have to be shut down for refueling or making repairs, or occasionally because something fails. And then the baseload sources of power would meet the minimal demand. And then there would be other periods of time when the demand is higher, when other plants, the so-called peaking plants, were built. And these were typically sources of energy like single stage natural gas plants or even hydropower could be utilized in this fashion, where the output goes up when the demand goes up and comes down when the demand comes down. In contrast, the baseload plant sort of operated at a steady level typically. Now, that model of trying to manage electricity just does not work for renewables like solar and wind. These are, as I mentioned earlier, variable sources of power in that the output depends on how fast the wind is blowing or how much the sun is shining. Intermittent is actually, I think, a poor word to describe them. Intermittent suggests that we don't know when they are going to be generating power. We actually know pretty well when the solar plants are going to be generating power, when the wind turbines are going to be generating power, because you can predict what the weather is going to be like a day ahead, for example. So these are variable and not intermittent. And with variable renewables, they are neither baseload nor peak. Now, as long as these are a very small fraction of the electricity supply, we can still think in terms of baseload and peak, and then the renewables just kind of complicate the picture, but they don't really alter it in a big way. But as renewables have become cheaper, solar and wind are the cheapest ways to generate electricity around the world today, and the scale of the climate crisis has become more obvious, we've seen a large expansion in these variable renewables. And once that variable component of the electricity supply becomes quite large, let's say 30%, then it becomes almost impossible to operate any of these baseload plants in a baseload fashion without some kind of economic penalty. What I mean by that is there are going to be times of the day or the year when the wind and the solar plants are generating more electricity than the demand is. And the special feature of wind and solar is that once you build the wind turbine or set up the solar plant, it pretty much produces electricity for free because the maintenance costs of these are fairly small and they don't require any fuel. And therefore, it makes economic sense to utilize them to the maximum extent possible. And if they are supplying as much as the demand is, then the economically sensible thing to do is to shut down everything else, the coal plants, the nuclear plants, the natural gas plants, because all of these are going to have higher marginal costs, higher costs of the fueling and all of the other costs associated with running these plants. But when you do so, when you shut down a nuclear plant, there are some safety concerns, and also there's some wear and tear. And so the owners of these plants typically don't like to shut them down. And so there have been situations where they would actually pay the solar and wind generators to turn down their plants so that the coal plant or the nuclear plant can continue operating. This is why there are so-called negative spot prices on the electricity market. And this is a phenomenon that suggests that actually this old outmoded idea of having baseload generating sources actually does not make sense. And going forward, this is going to make even less and less sense. So the reason why we are hearing still this sort of mantra of we need baseload is because people who have grown up trying to manage the grid in a certain way are finding it difficult to understand or to change their ways of thinking. And what we really need is a new paradigm of trying to manage electricity grids with renewables. And there's a lot of theoretical work that shows that we can actually operate the grid pretty reliably for very, very high levels of renewables. There are a lot of studies which even show that in theoretically 100% renewable energy grid is possible. In the real world, we have not seen that happen except for very short periods of time, but not on a consistent basis. But there are going to be some questions about what sources of electricity storage are going to be economically viable in the future, which are going to become the cheapest. There is a big emphasis on research and development of different kinds of energy storage technologies, and it's too early to predict which one of these technologies is going to take the lead. There are quite likely going to be multiple kinds of storage technologies that are going to become economically viable, and different jurisdictions will probably adopt different ones based on their local circumstances. In any case, just to say that I think the evolving landscape of electricity generation and grid management is something that is evolving. It's too early to say how it's going to go.
And some of the problems that the nuclear industry, as I understand it, claims to be solving are to some extent an artifact of the industry itself and its system of producing electricity and how it relates to other sources of energy. It's not as though it's a kind of virtuous supplier coming in to save the day.
Right. The supplier coming in to solve the problems that they have set for themselves.
Right.
This is one way to think about it.
Yeah. I wanted to also take up an issue that's, of course, always haunted this industry, and that is the connection between nuclear energy and nuclear weapons. You make this point that they're inseparable and kind of inhere in the very production of nuclear energy. And I think as someone who's been interested as a psychologist in the propaganda aspect of this industry and how it's promoted and tried to repackage this lethal product, there's always been and continues to be an effort to disconnect nuclear energy from its deathly legacies with the atomic bomb and nuclear weapons, and to kind of dissociate itself by placing that all in the past, using terms like clean and safe over and over again. And so they have to remind people. And it's interesting what gets repeated over and over makes you wonder, thou claim too much. You know, you don't hear people with solar energy continuing to say, safe, safe, safe. But over and over, we hear the mantra of clean and safe in the promotion of this new generation of small reactors. What is your thesis as you develop the connections in your book between nuclear energy and nuclear weapons?
Yeah, the industry has a split personality when it comes to talking about this connection. Usually their argument is that nuclear energy is completely different from nuclear weapons. For example, pro-nuclear advocates would say, oh, a nuclear reactor cannot explode like a nuclear bomb, or it does not actually produce bombs and things of that sort. And that is true, but it misses the multiple other connections. Just to give sort of numbers, when I was finishing the book, I checked the International Atomic Energy Agency's database, and they listed 275 out of the 410 reactors that IAEA had marked as operating were in countries that had nuclear weapons. And then there are a whole bunch of other countries like Canada and Japan and so on, which are allied with nuclear weapon states. And if you include all of them, the overlap is overwhelming. So there's something should be puzzling to any advocate for nuclear power. Why is this, there's this strong overlap, right? And the reason is, all nuclear plants require uranium, usually in an enriched fashion. And the technology that goes into making enrichment is also the technology that can be used to purify your uranium, to enrich it to a point where it can be used to make nuclear weapons. And this is why there's a lot of concern about Iran's nuclear program. The second is that all nuclear reactors also produce plutonium. Plutonium comes because inside the reactor, the uranium will absorb neutrons and get converted into plutonium. And this plutonium can be separated and used to make nuclear weapons. Historically, this is how countries like India developed nuclear weapons. The United States also, the first nuclear reactors were constructed to make plutonium for the Manhattan Project. And some of this plutonium was used in the bomb that was dropped on Nagasaki.
But defenders of this new, very few countries and places are talking about building these traditional light water reactors. Here we have in the U.S. these large nuclear power plants, and instead these small reactors. And the proponents claim that they produce very small amounts of weapons grade plutonium.
Yeah. So,
small reactors?
Yeah, a small reactor will naturally produce less plutonium, but it also produces a smaller amount of electricity. So if you are thinking about growing electricity needs, which is another argument that the nuclear advocates keep putting out, saying that we are going to require more and more electricity going forward, then you're going to be building lots of these small reactors. And once you're, even a small reactor, by the way, produces a lot of plutonium when you think about the requirement to make nuclear weapons. My colleague Alex Glaser calculated once that even a 200 megawatt reactor, which is, very small, it's about a tenth of the size of the two reactors that started up in Georgia in the Vogtle plant. That 200 megawatt reactor could produce enough plutonium to fuel about 10 nuclear weapons every year, right? And so you're going to be seeing a very large amount of plutonium if you're going to be building large numbers of these small reactors. But the point is actually something more fundamental, that there is no way to build a nuclear reactor that does not produce plutonium, unless you're going to use thorium, in which case you'll be producing uranium-233, which is another material that can be used to make nuclear weapons. So there's a deep technical connection. But if I may also point out, there are two other important connections that get left out a lot. One is that the people who are trained to design and operate nuclear plants also receive inadvertently a lot of training required for running a nuclear weapons program, at least some components of the nuclear weapons program. There's a lot of overlap. And the, again, historical example for this comes from Pakistan, where they had a severe dearth of personnel who could be trained to design and operate nuclear plants. And the US Atoms for Peace program was the route through which several Pakistani scientists and engineers got trained. And some of these people were the ones who eventually went and helped set up the Pakistan nuclear weapons program. And then the last connection, which I want to emphasize, is that in many, many countries, the institutions that promote nuclear energy are precisely the same institutions that also oversee nuclear weapons. So in the United States, it's the Department of Energy that is both promoting nuclear energy and also in charge of all the nuclear weapons-related activities, maintaining the stockpile, trying to produce new material, for example, tritium for nuclear weapons, and so on and so forth. So there's a strong institutional connection as well. And as I mentioned in the beginning, pro-nuclear advocates tend to underplay the connections, except when they require government subsidies. So in the middle of the last decade, as a lot of nuclear plants were being shut down, you saw a large number of nuclear power advocates making the argument that the government should subsidize nuclear power precisely because it has these national security, quote unquote, benefits. And in the United States, they typically also point to the fact that a large number of people who go and work in the Navy in their nuclear submarines, when they retire, they often go to work in nuclear plants. And so you need to keep these nuclear plants operating so that the Navy can continue to attract people to go and work on their nuclear weapon submarines.
This explains some of the secrecy around nuclear technology as well.
Absolutely. Many institutions use the fact that there's this connection with the military to argue that the public should not be allowed information or allowed to be looking into or being able to monitor what's happening in these facilities. I'll also mention that there are a large number of corporations which are involved in both developing nuclear energy and in nuclear weapons related work. Or more broadly, defense-related work.
I want to close by letting listeners know how they can see you featured in the documentary film Atomic Bamboozle this month. But before we turn to that in closing, say something as well about nuclear energy as an environmental justice issue.
So, a nuclear plant is just one element of the infrastructure we need to generate nuclear energy. The nuclear reactor requires a whole chain of processes, starting with mining uranium to processing it, to enriching it, to converting that into fuel. And then, after the fuel leaves the nuclear reactor, it's often stored in temporary waste, spent fuel pools. And eventually, the hope is that there's going to be some kind of a geological repository where this could be buried. And at each stage, there are people who are being exposed to radiation, who might be subject to accidents, who might sort of bear the brunt of accidents and so on. And what's also important is that a lot of the, especially the uranium mining stage and the end stage, that is repositories, are being targeted or have happened historically in areas that are populated by indigenous communities. And they have often borne the brunt of these kind of activities, and they have had very little say in how these operations are run, and they have not been compensated often. In the United States, there was also the Radiation Compensation Act that was not passed by US Congress, which basically leaves many, many people who were victims of nuclear weapons testing, which, although is not part of the nuclear energy production, is being operated by exactly the same kind of entities that operate nuclear power plants. So the way that they think about these populations as expendable, as the populations that have to be in these kind of sacrificial zones, and then they don't get compensated ultimately, I think that's telling something about the kind of outlook that we are confronting.
Yeah. In closing, I want to let listeners know that they can see you featured in the documentary film Atomic Bamboozle: The False Promise of a Nuclear Renaissance, as well as read your excellent new book, The Sierra Club in the United States. The nuclear-free team of the Sierra Club is screening Atomic Bamboozle for free for the full month of September online through Eventive. That's Eventive, Eventive. The platform, which includes a webinar on Monday, September 30th. And I look forward to joining you for that webinar, along with other scientists and anti-nuclear activists. To register, just go to Eventive Atomic Bamboozle. And we hope listeners will spread the word about your work and the way you lay out this terrain that we face of false claims as well as technical claims and debunk them so effectively in the film and in your book. So thank you so much, MV Ramana, for your work in exposing the false promises of the nuclear industry. And congratulations again on your book, Nuclear is Not the Solution, published this year through Verso Press.
Thank you, Jan, and I'd like to thank you not just for inviting me here, but also for your excellent work in exposing the lies and the false claims the nuclear industry makes through your film Atomic Bamboozle.
Oh, thank you so much. We still got our work cut out for us, don't we?
Unfortunately, yes.
Okay, take care. We'll see you soon.
Take care, Jan. Bye-bye.